Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Let's give it up for GEICO for supporting the Steve Austin Show for all these years. In just 15 minutes, you could save 15% or more on car insurance. GEICO has been offering great rates and great service for over 75 years. And anytime you need help, you can speak to one of their trained specialists 24/7. Go to GEICO.com and start saving cash. Extra money in your pocket? It may just be the most rewarding thing you do today.
The following program is a PodcastOne.com production.
From Hollywood, California, by way of the Broken Skull Ranch, this is the Steve Austin Show.
Give me a hell yeah.
Hell yeah.
Now, here's Steve Austin.
All right, everybody, welcome to Steve Austin Show. I am coming to you from the mean streets of Los Angeles, California today. I'm over here at the Broken Skull Studio, about to open up a can of whoop-ass with my longtime friend, former stunt double, former pro wrestler, former MMA fighter, current stuntman, current actor, Paul Lazenby. Paul, if you listened to the show, did I pump you up enough? Shit. Paul came into town to take care of some business in the movie industry, and also to check out the New Japan Pro Wrestling Show. I believe that show happens on Monday, which would have been yesterday as far as this show goes. So Paul came over, we drank a couple of beers, we ate a couple of pizzas, we watched a little bit of the AEW pay-per-view, and then came over here and just shot the breeze for about an hour. And man, I was starting to get into some of the good stuff that Paul used to like in the business of pro wrestling, and turns out he's a big tag team fan. So we started talking about tag teams, and I was totally not expecting the conversation to go there. So we start talking about some of our favorite tag teams in the history of the business. And if I left anybody off that list that should have been on there, that would have been my fault. But I didn't think we was going to go down that rabbit hole, and we did, and had a good time talking about it. And then we segue into a couple of things that got under my skin over the weekend and some of the things that happened to me with my illustrious iPhone. I told my wife, I said, and I'll cover this in the podcast as well, I'm going to go back caveman style. I'm going to get me a flip phone and piss on all this modern technology. I'm done with it. I think I'll keep this phone because it should last me another 20 years unless they start making it glitch out or something to force me to go get another one. I'm going to put this thing in a steel case and protect it with my life. These sumbitches are so damn expensive. What a ripoff. I'll get into the story on the podcast. But nonetheless, I'm going back to the flip phone. I think we got one in the closet somewhere, and I'm going to buy some minutes for it. And as a matter of fact, I shot a commercial for that a couple of years ago. It's an old Kyocera flip phone. I hope the summit still works, because that's what I'm going back to. To hell with all this new school stuff. I've had enough technology in my life to just really sour my mood towards it and how I feel about it. So flip phone, here I come. But I digress. Great conversation with my old buddy Paul Lazenby from Vancouver, BC. And we stayed up kind of late last night over here at the Broken Skull Studio drinking ice cold Broken Skull IPA. And I don't think Paul drinks too much beer too often. He might have a drink here or there. And by the time his Uber came, he was walking about halfway sideways to that thing. So I wonder if he woke up with a headache or not. Nonetheless, enjoy the podcast with myself and Paul Lazenby, shooting the breeze, laughing our fool heads off, and having a good time. Driving all around town to get all your office supplies in order is, quite frankly, a waste of time. You pick up a file cabinet one place just to hop in the car to go across town to get some electrical tape. What's the point of that? Well, our friends at Zorro.com are here to make it hassle-free because they got everything you need in one place. Zorro.com, spelled Z-O-R-O, is where you'll find everything you need for businesses of any size and almost any industry. Electrical, plumbing, contracting, manufacturing, don't sweat it because Zorro has you covered. Zorro.com has tools and equipment, safety and office supplies, cleaning items, and more from brands you know and trust, such as Stanley, 3M, Milwaukee, Schneider, and Rubbermaid, just to name a few. Zorro.com offers amazing customer service from real people based in the U.S., and you'll dig the fast, free shipping on orders of $50 or more. Just for a little stuff of Steve Austin Show, visit Zorro.com/Austin to sign up for Zmail and get 15% off your first order. Again, that's Zorro.com/Austin for 15% off your first order. Zorro.com/Austin. Get it all in one place.
The Steve Austin Show. The Steve Austin Show.
All right, check. Talk to me.
Check, ABC.
All right, we've been doing this 5 or 6 minutes. Hell, I had Steve Reeve on. I faded in like a DJ. We started talking Texas blues music. What the hell brings you to town, Paul Lazenby, my former stunt double? I was in the low-budget movie business in Vancouver, Canada. You son of a bitch, you. It's good to see you.
Likewise, man. Well, it's any excuse I get to come down here and drink your beer is an excuse I'm going to jump on. But this time it is that I'm in town to see some of my buddies in New Japan Pro Wrestling. They got a show at the Globe Theater this coming Tuesday, November 11th.
Who are you going to see?
Well, Juice Robinson's a good friend of mine. He's sorting out the passes for myself and for Boss Rutan. He's going to come down too, and you're welcome to come if you want. And also Minoru Suzuki, who tortured me many a time in the Pancrase Dojo, will be down there. And Dave Finley too. And there's a few guys. Jay White's a good friend. El Fantasmo is a buddy of mine from Vancouver who's now doing really well in New Japan. So there's quite a few people I want to see.
Jesus Christ, I didn't know he was going to drop all those names on me. Hey, man, I was impressed with Juice Robinson a couple years ago when I saw you at the same show. Well, it was in Long Beach, it's a different building.
Yeah, their first American show.
Man, that dude, hell of a damn worker, and he's been cutting some lights-out promos. I've seen a lot of stuff on YouTube, and he turned into a silver-tongued devil, so he dropped some cool stuff. But is he just going to stay in Japan? And I don't mean just stay in Japan, but is he focused in Japan? Will he ever decide to work America? What's his deal?
The last time I talked to him, and I don't know if his mind has changed since then, but I think he made a very shrewd decision. He told me his intention was staying in New Japan. He likes it there. You know, he likes the way the company's treating him. And sitting back and just looking at it from my perspective, I can see where he made a very educated decision, because he was a solid mid-card guy who was on the rise. And that was when Kenny Omega was there, and the Young Bucks were there, and a lot of those big names left and went to AEW. And he recognized, because I'm sure he had offers all over the place. A lot of people like Juice Robinson. You know, a lot of people want him on their roster. But I'm sure he realized that with all those guys leaving New Japan, that created a vacuum. And him being one of the top guys on the mid-card, now it makes him one of the top guys at the top of the card.
Dude, how tall is that guy?
He's about 6'2".
Oh, good eye.
He's a big kid.
Yeah. What's he weigh?
I think around 220, 220, 230, something like that.
I remember when we were in Japan, he was one of the guys that jumped off the card at me. He impressed me with his works. He was good shit.
Yeah,
it's interesting. Good decision, though, because, you know, with the shakeup of everything that's happened in the landscape of pro wrestling in the last 6, 9, 12 months, because I don't think AEW just happened overnight, kind of been a work in progress with a couple of pay-per-views before Tony Khan got involved. You and I just sat down in my living room. We just watched a little bit of AEW pay-per-view. But just the landscape has changed. And then, you know, hell, with everything that's going on, we were talking about the NWA stuff on YouTube. And I got turned on to it, and I was surfing last night, and I saw a little bit of the look and feel of it. Only I was kind of fading out, so I don't remember all of the matches. But I got a taste of it. But you're kind of into it, aren't you?
I'm hugely into it, because my favorite type of wrestling is NWA, and I particularly love those Jim Crockett studio wrestling shows where you got like 200 people watching, if that. And they would go behind the counter and cut their promos afterward. And this is laid out in very much the same way, with very much the same feel. And now they do, there's wrinkles that need to be ironed out. They got some of the people are green and so on. But then they've got a lot of diamonds in the rough, too. They got some very seasoned talents there. I was happy to see Eddie Kingston and Homicide there. I like both those guys. The up-and-comers like the Dawsons, who I love, they're total old-school heels. And it just, overall, it has a lot of the flavor of what I love about that mid-'80s and early 80s wrestling brought into the modern day.
And people always ask me, hey, man, what's your favorite stuff to watch? Yeah, I loved what we're doing in Attitude Era, but I always tell everybody the mid-'80s stuff from NWA was what I cut my teeth on. Well, I grew up on Houston wrestling because that's, you know, the stuff that we were getting. It was very regional back then. And then when I started getting, you know, world-class championship wrestling, before it got into the later 80s and started on the decline when it was still running red hot, and in Mid-South, that old-school stuff that had that vibe. And a little bit of that, and a lot of the NWA stuff was filmed in arenas or crowds or whatever buildings they were in. It wasn't necessarily studio, but it just has that feel, that gritty, that tough, lower production value. It was just a product of the times. So it was current, but it just wasn't so glossed up. And we're not crapping on anything, because high production values are what you always shoot for, but that's what I remember the most, and I can feel, taste, and smell that shit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm the same way, man. I like a lot of different styles of wrestling, but when it's gritty and it feels more real, You know, and it's that was always the message I got from NWA is, you know, we're not dressing this up. This is a fight, and sometimes it's ugly, and sometimes it's dirty, and that's what makes me connect more. That's what makes me care more when the babyface is getting his ass kicked. That's what makes me care more when the heel's on top and when he's getting his ass kicked. It just, to me, it lent more of an air of legitimacy to wrestling when it was like that.
Okay, so with that being said, and if you were watching NWA back in the day, I mean, what were your thoughts of Ric Flair?
Oh, man, he's the man. And, you know, he was just, I was automatically engaged as soon as he was on TV. You know, when I'm talking about my favorites, I was more into baby faces when I was a kid. So it was like Tony Atlas and Rocky Johnson.
You pussy.
I was a fat nerd.
I'm not saying it because the name said, but when you said baby faces, I'm like, come on, man. Yeah. I got to get a little bit of heat on you. No, but keep going.
My interest in wrestling actually started, and it's funny because I've been impossible to deal with the last few days because Sergeant Slaughter just started following me on Twitter, so now I think I'm all that. But it reminded me that what got me into wrestling as a kid was the feud between Don Kernodle and Sergeant Slaughter against Jay Youngblood and Ricky Steamboat. And so Steamboat and Youngblood were my first favorite tag team, and then it was Atlas and Johnson after that. And that's what really got the ball rolling for me in wrestling. I just loved it.
So were you more into the tag teams, or you like singles as well?
I like well-built singles matches, but I always gravitated more toward the tag teams.
Man, and that's the thing. The tag team scene just ain't what it used to be.
No.
And that's not knocking any team that's out there. I'm just saying it's just not as many teams, and they're not together as long to build the history, the chemistry, and just you know what the other guy is going to do. And you just go out there, and when you have four different people out there and a referee – with all the minds and all the different things, that the tricks that you can do, there's so much to watch. So I love tag team wrestling, but it just seems like it's kind of, you know, faded off a little bit. And that's with all respect to the tag teams that are still out there doing good work.
It
just has changed.
Yeah, and also there's not as much attention to the mechanics of tag team wrestling. I mean, it's and again, I'm not crapping on the modern product, but there is a little bit more nudge, nudge, wink, wink. We're all in this together. And so you get like, okay, well, he's not the legal man, but it doesn't really matter because it's fake. Or, you know, they're both members of the team are in the ring for 30 seconds doing high spots when it's not legal to be in there that long, but it doesn't matter because it's fake. And back in the day, there's a little bit more of the adherence to the rules, which made it more important.
Okay, with that being said, then who would you say would be some of your tag teams that you really liked?
I was big on the British Bulldogs.
Yeah, great tag team.
Yeah, I really love those guys. And
I thought in that tag team, I thought Davey was a solid guy, but I thought Dynamite kind of set the tone of the pace because he had that mean streak, and that's with respect to Davey. You know, Davey was a hell of a damn worker, but Dynamite was kind of he set the tone.
Yeah, for Nass and Crawford, for sure.
God dang, and those guys got overlooked, and I think they're underrated here in the stateside scene, but in Japan, those guys were all Japan, right?
Yes, they were.
Okay, holy smokes, some of the finishes those guys would do, and the matches in and of themselves, and the fact that Doug Furness was a world-class powerlifter, and when he stopped powerlifting to focus on, you know, professional wrestling, hell, he hadn't even reached his peak. So who knows? And you're big into powerlifting.
Huge.
So you know that, you know, had Doug Furness just focused on powerlifting, he probably would have been. He's considered one of the all-time greats in my estimation. But, dude, he might have every record that there ever was. But, man, to go back just to the work, Furness and Crawford, when they came to WWF way back in the day, it was like they kind of didn't really fit in to the scene that was. But as far as work, badass.
And they were kind of on the downslide at that point, too.
Correct.
You know, unfortunately, you know, Crawford, who, you know, he used to come into the Fox and Firkin Tavern when I was bouncing there my first year in the business and get me drunker than anybody else in the bar every Friday and Saturday night. He's a great guy, but, you know, he's had his issues that were kind of taken a little bit away from his game by the WWF days. And for Nass, I believe it had an auto accident or two, and he had some injuries he was dealing with. So even at a reduced level, those guys were fantastic. You're right. They just maybe weren't a proper fit for that company at that time. But, damn, I've told you this before on this show. I have two favorite matches of all time that run neck and neck, and one of them was, I believe, the 92 match of the year. First time I saw it, Lance Storm showed it to me on VHS in his basement apartment, and that was for Nass and Crawford against Kikuchi and Kobashi for the All-Asian Tag Team titles in All Japan. And, oh, my God, go to YouTube and find that match if you haven't seen it. It's just one hellacious match.
What was the other one?
The other one is Gary Albright against
Dude, you're a big Gary Albright fan.
I'm a huge Gary Albright was Brock before Brock was Brock, man. Yeah. The human suplex machine. Before and Taz, I'm not even gonna say due respect to Taz because I've had my issues with the guy. He was a good worker, but you know, the only suplex machine in my eyes was Gary Albright. He was just fantastic, and UWFI was the best place for him, war chute style. And that was my introduction to mixed martial arts. It was before the UFC even came to pass. My buddy Dr. Luther brought some UWFI videotapes back from Japan in 1992, and he showed them to me. And I thought, what is this? I'd never seen fights where guys were up and down, and I thought it was a shoot. I was that uneducated at the time. And just Gary Albright looked like the scariest dude in the world to me, 340, 350-pound dude with lightning-fast suplexes and agile for a dude his size, just whipping people all over the ring. It just that match engaged me so much and introduced me to MMA, so it's always going to be one of my favorite matches.
All right, British Bulldogs, Furness and Crawford, keep going.
I'm trying to think, man. I think those are my top two. You know,
I mean, was the Hart Foundation in there at all? I mean, this was going to be later in WWF, but
I didn't know enough about wrestling. I liked the Hart Foundation, but I didn't know enough about wrestling as a mark to appreciate how good those guys were and how well they played their roles and dovetailed them together. I didn't really have an appreciation of Brett until well into his title reign. You know, I'll tell like Lance Storm, who trained me, I'll say, like, I understand the business way better now than I did when I was in it. You know, I even when I was a worker, I didn't understand like I do now. So I look back on, and we were just talking about Stan Hansen before we fired up the microphones.
Yeah.
Another guy I didn't appreciate when I was a fan because I didn't know enough about the business to know how good that guy is. So,
okay, but what about Brody Hansen in Japan?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, if you get on YouTube and you go down a rabbit hole, wormhole, whatever kind of asshole it is, you start surfing around, you're going to end up on Brody Hansen, especially because you like New Japan-style wrestling. They were more All Japan guys, but...
Yeah, definitely they're up there. The Road Warriors for sure.
Right. You know, they changed the business.
Yes, absolutely. You know, I was a huge Road Warriors fan. Just because of that. You know,
okay, now if you're gonna talk old school NWA, you have to throw in there, well, I can't tell you what you have to like to throw in there because it's your list. But you and me are talking, we've had a couple of beers. Midnight Express, Rock and Roll Express. I mean,
and again, those are two teams I kick myself over because I watched them now. Like, how did I not see it back in there? They were so good. Bobby Eaton is never. I don't care if Bobby Eaton starts getting massive amounts of credit now and gets it for the rest of his life. He will never get the credit that he's due for how good a worker he was. And I'm giving due credit to Stan Lane. I'm giving due credit to Dennis Condrey. Those guys were great. But just every time I watch a Midnight Express match, like, how did I not see it?
Bobby was kind of X-factor. And he was so underrated in the things he did, the way he implemented the second rope and a lot of his bumps, some of the sequences he did that were off the beaten path, and just his way of selling the quick right hand, the clotheslines, the Alabama Jam. I mean, man, you just go on and on. His presentation, the lockups. When I took a TV title off of him when I first came through there, I guess it was 91, you know, I couldn't lace that guy's boots, you know, and there I am beating him for the damn world television title. So he's so important in my career, but I was a huge fan of that guy. And then when you talk about, you know, Rock and Roll Express, Ricky Morton, people used to say, chicks crying on the front row. He used a different word. Chicks crying on the front row. And this is just an ongoing story in the locker room with the boys, right? Chicks crying in the front row. Because they were. They were literally crying. And when they hit the rock and roll music, it was like everybody had a different kind of pop, right? But when they had the rock and roll music, it was like a high, shrill pop because it was like all the chicks. And don't get me wrong, guys loved them too. Mm. But, I mean, the chicks really loved them. Two good-looking young white meat baby faces. And Ricky would go out there and sell his ass off and literally be crying on the front row, people hanging from the rafters. And then, you know, Robert Fire in, make that comeback and, you know, do some double-team stuff. And, you know, they really implemented the teamwork. And you felt for those guys. You could get heat on those guys.
Mm.
And watch this. Of the matches with, you know, Ole and Arn, or I was a big fan.
Oh yeah, I got to mention Ole and Arn too. I'm gonna kill myself if I don't put them on the list.
Yeah, but also Jesus Christ, before Ole and Arn, well, Gene and Ole, that's going a little bit far back. But I was a big fan of Ole and Arn as much as I was with Arn and Tully.
I liked Arn and Tully a little bit better just because it was a bit of a Ole and Arn. They were very similar, which isn't a bad thing. But I like tag teams that are a contrast. Like the Hart Foundation, I should have appreciated them more because they're contrasting teams. And even Hawk and Animal were kind of contrasting.
Well, the thing I liked about Ole, though, because, you know, Tully had that cocky demeanor, hell of a damn worker. And, you know, him and Arn were, you know, kind of similar in a way. They both had the same gears. But Ole was the heater, you know, when it was him and Arn. So I like that. He'd come in and be that big bully heel, especially working with the rock and roll. And so that was another one of my tag teams that I really got into.
I mentioned we were talking online a little while ago, and I mentioned it, one team that I always overlooked. I've been watching old AWA matches from the mid-80s, and the Rock and Roll RPMs were a great team to put in there with any team you want to get over.
I agree.
Yeah.
Because Rock and Roll RPMs was Mike Davis and, man, I'm kicking myself because you brought that name out of the blue.
Yeah, I shouldn't know. I brought it up.
And man, I'm
going to Google it right now because I'm doing this guy's a disservice by not knowing their names.
I'll tell you another name from a different federation was Fantastics.
Yeah.
Bobby Fulton, Tommy Rogers.
Yep.
Man, those guys, they could sell their asses off, good-looking kids. And God dang, I had Tommy Rogers on the podcast a long time ago, and he passed away. He was living in Hawaii. Bobby Fulton is still with us. Hell, I had a phone call with him about a year ago. But those guys were damn good workers. You get heat on them, good-looking. People loved them. They were invested in them, had great fire. It could do all the moves, but you felt they weren't just flash. They weren't just a bunch of moves. You gave a shit about them. You cared about them.
Yeah. I again, going back to Landstorm's basement apartment, another match I saw down there for the first time, I think it was Clash of the Champions 1. It was a Fantastics, I believe, against the Midnight Express. But I just remember total chaos for that entire match. And it wasn't a schmoz, like just a bunch of guys doing high spots. You know, there was a method to it. They were telling a story. You know, the baby faces were either both up or both fighting to get up. And I just remember that match being insane. Like, it really stood out to me among the tag team matches I've seen.
The Rockers, Marty Jannetty and Shawn Michaels, a lot of times, well, not a lot of times, because Shawn was probably the greatest in-ring performer I've ever seen in my life. Those guys were outstanding. But Shawn's singles career is so strong, sometimes you forget about the Rockers. But if you love tag team wrestling, you can't forget about them.
No. Circling back real quick, Tommy Lane and Mike Davis were the RPMs.
What's the guy's name?
Tommy Lane and Mike
Davis. Tommy Lane. God dang it. You know, I used to also have I kind of used to like the Beverly Brothers.
Oh, yeah.
Mike Ennis and Wayne Bloom.
Yeah.
But before they were Beverly Brothers, when they were in the AWA, what was their name in AWA?
The Destruction Crew.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Those guys were good.
And then Ennis was a referee before that, because some of the matches I'm watching now, he was a ref, and then he was a jobber in just like random tag teams.
Yeah. We went on a tour. I think he was on a tour of Japan with us one time. I think it was that tour when it was over for about 3 weeks, when me and Arn damn near went crazy because we were stateside guys, and we went over to Japan. We were like, dude, what the fuck? We're used to traveling in our rental cars, doing our gimmicks, our things, and going to the hotel room or the lobby, and all of a sudden you work, you take a shower, and you get on a bus, and you ain't got no beer. It's like, hey, get
that's
us
barbarism,
out of here,
man.
Yeah, Rod Simmons on that crew, Dean Malenko, Chris Benoit, Eddie Guerrero. It was like an all-star crew. Where do we go from here? I'm a tag team wrestler.
Actually, while we're talking tag teams, you brought up Malenko's name, and I got to bring up one match that I've never given Joe Malenko the credit he deserves because I didn't see too many of his matches. I came across an All-Japan match between the British Bulldogs and the Malenko brothers, and Joe Malenko is I've always known Dean was awesome. Joe was fantastic, man. He's so good. Not the kind of guy whose charisma is going to blow the roof off. But you put him in there, and he just looks deadly with everything he does. He's so crisp. His moves, his technique is so great. That was one of the greatest matches I've seen.
Well, when I went to WCW, I was coming out of USWA. When I got the call, I went down there, and they were doing a lot of pay-per-views with a lot of tag matches. And Joe and Dean were tagging together at that time. You know, Joe was, I guess, a little bit older, I'm assuming, because Dean stayed around longer. But, man, as a tag team, those guys were so technical, so proficient, so good, and such a team. Of course, their dad being Boris Malenko, and they trained people. They had a camp. You know, I thought I was pretty good. I was pretty cocky at the time. You know, you think you're good when you're green, and you ain't, but you just have this, you know how you would get, right?
Yeah.
You're competitive, and you're dumb, but you think you know everything. But when I saw those guys work, it was kind of like next-level stuff, and it was intimidating because – it was like, man, these guys have so much knowledge, and I got 101 chain wrestling skills. I got no mic skills. My ring psychology, man, is about a 2.5 out of 10. So watching those guys go about business, it was like, man, I got a long ways to go.
Yeah, they would set the bar high, man. It's something to be inspired by, and you got to fight not to be intimidated by it or you know, disconsolate about it because they're so good. You know, the first time I saw Dean Malenko work, I remember thinking, like, there's no way I'm ever going to work like that. I'm going to have to find another way to be successful because I'm never going to get close to that guy.
Did you watch much ECW wrestling when Dean was kind of doing that thing where he wasn't talking a whole lot?
I wish I could have. You know, I was so broke during the late 90s and early 2000s that I didn't see many of your matches. I didn't have cable. I didn't have a telephone. And me and Dr. Luther were so poor, man. We're like, we'd scrape a lot of change together and see who's got the most change. And we'd go to Dairy Queen and we'd go to 7-Eleven. We'd have burritos and we'd have like sundaes. So, yeah, I it sucks. You know, I missed it. My wife was in the Attitude Era, and I never got to see any of her work on screen because we didn't have cable. So it sucked. You know, I missed a lot of ECW. I remember going down to train MMA in Indiana with a guy named Gary Myers, and he had cable. So I saw some of it there. And in Japan, funny enough, my manager at the time, Phyllis Lee, told me to kayfabe that I was a worker because he said they'll kick you out. They're shooters, and they hate workers. And I get there, and they're doing nothing but watching ECW and All Japan. They consider themselves workers that just happen to do shoots. So I got to see some of it there, too. I loved whatever I got to see of it.
Well, it was kind of different because you're, like, waiting for him to talk. There was that suddenness that never came. But then all of a sudden, when you ring the bell, he's like a machine. You know, Dean Smooth is a sumbitch, and Brett always gets credit with being the most technical wrestler in the history of the WWE, and everybody knows how much I love Brett. I mean, Dean was a technical wrestler. To me, Brett was a worker's worker, good at all things, especially laying out, working, building a match. Mm-hmm. As far as being technical, Dean Malenko was very technical.
Oh, I would say definitely. Like, if you're talking just shoot technique or adapting shoot
for
working.
Correct. That's what I'm saying.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, I see what you mean about that silent. It's kind of funny. It just hit me now hearing you talk about it, but that's kind of what Fedor had going on. Mm-hmm. It's just the strong, silent type. And it doesn't work for everybody. You can easily look boring when you do that, but there's certain guys that they just sit there and they do nothing and they give you nothing with their face, and it actually contributes to their aura because when they get in the ring, they throw down.
Man, I'm throwing out some tag team names with you, and I'm forgetting a lot because I wasn't prepared for the conversation we were going to have. But when you say Guerrero, I got to thank Eddie Guerrero and Art Barr. Because, dude, the match that they had with – it was over with Triple A.
Was that the World's Collide pay-per-view?
Yeah. Who was that?
Working with you.
How can I forget their friggin' opponents?
Yeah, I'm going to Google that now.
Okay, Google that. But that was a hell of a tag team.
Yeah, absolutely. Los Gringos Locos.
Yeah. And so while you're researching that, people always – just recently on Twitter, about a week ago, people were talking about tag teams, and some people were saying, hey, man, do the Hollywood Blondes belong on the Mount Rushmore of tag team wrestling? And I stayed out of the conversation, but I'll address it here. Hell no. We're not even close. We're not even in the top 15 or 20. Brian and I were good for the time that we were together. We could have been excellent, but we were good. And had we had as much time together or as many matches as a lot of other tag teams, I would venture to say we would have been in the conversation. But no, we're not in the conversation. We never were. But, man, I had a lot of fun with Brian. Were we good? Damn right. Did we have chemistry? Yes, we did. But we're not in that conversation, not even close to it. So I had to address that. Did you find it yet?
Yeah, I did. I just found it now. It's why isn't that telling me who was in it, though? I was talking about the match without giving me the teams in it.
That cannot be possible. Are you on Wikipedia?
Octagon and El Hijo del Santo. Does that sound familiar?
I guess it does. And I don't mean to, disregard them or be disrespectful because, I mean, that was a hell of a match and just pulled out of my ass.
Yeah,
El Hijo
del Santo and Octagon.
Yeah.
Octagon is still working from what I understand.
Well, man, it was weird, because, Art Barr passed away. And, of course, and Eddie later would. Bad ending to that tag team.
Yeah, it and I wish I could have seen more of them. I keep hearing about, especially after I relocated to Vancouver, which is just above the Pacific Northwest, where, the Barr families are very well known. And I always heard about how great he was. Jericho was a really good friend of mine. I always hear from him how great Art Barr was. And I didn't get to see a lot of his stuff.
Jericho's a smart guy. I mean, he's kind of a wrestler's wrestler. He studies the business, has a great recall on the history of the business. When did you meet Jericho?
I met Jericho in 1991. I moved 2,000 miles from my hometown to become a professional wrestler and train at the Hart Brothers Pro Wrestling Academy. And I ended up training at a Hart Brothers school. Didn't have any Hart Brothers in it because Keith Hart showed up for the first 2 days to make sure all the checks cleared. And then he took off and we never saw him again. So that was my first lesson in what wrestling is like. But I got lucky because Lance Storm and Chris, with Chris Jericho assisting him, were my instructors, and they hadn't even finished their own rookie year yet, but just being the prodigies that they were good enough to give us a good grounding in the business. And so I ended up getting a better education from rookies than I probably would have got from a lot of veterans who would have phoned it in. So that's where I met Chris, is as one of my instructors.
Have you seen much of his work in AEW?
I have, yeah. Seen – he's Jericho, man. I mean, he's going to do everything that you need to get over if you're good enough to get over in the ring. Like he knows what to do as a heel. He knows what to do as a face. He knows what to do to make people care about the match, and then it's up to you after that.
To me, right now, he's about as entertaining as it gets. He's pushing the envelope. He's edgy. You don't know what he's going to do, so you have that factor of what is he going to do because you just don't know right now. Now, it's level-headed. It's all thought out. You just don't know what he's going to do. He's unpredictable is what I'm saying. I like that feel. He feels dangerous.
Yeah.
He feels like he damn near unhinged, but he's very calculated. So just what he's putting out right now, I'm digging.
Yeah, and it's – I don't understand how he can plan this stuff out because it's all so different. It's so diverse, and he always seems to know when the right time to make a change is and what the right change to make is. Like when he started in with New Japan, you know, okay, well, I have to be a different Chris Jericho in Japan than I am in North America, and that's where that whole Painmaker gimmick started up. And, of course, turned out to be the right thing. It was something completely different. And now it's to the point where he's got it as kind of an alternate persona, like Muda had two personas and stuff, right, where it's like you might get Jericho, you might get the Painmaker that night who wrestles a different way. He's just a dude who seems to be able to see around corners and constantly find new ways to put himself out there and new ways to reinvent himself.
Man, while we were talking about tag teams, I said, hey, well, I wasn't prepared for a tag team conversation, but now that I'm looking at it, dude, I used to pay money to go down to the Sportatorium on Friday nights and Saturday mornings to watch the Fabulous Freebirds fight the Von Erichs. And this is when I was playing football for North Texas State University in Denton, Texas. So Fabulous Freebirds, I don't know how in tune with those guys you were, but they were lights out. When Michael Hayes would hit the second turnbuckle in that that rebel flag robe, and that's what it was. God dang, man. When that spotlight hit his ass and he started gyrating and putting on a show, and then you had the Heater, Bam Bam Gordy over there, and then, you know, Buddy Jack Roberts, who everybody in the building thought they could kick his ass. But, man, those guys were a hell of a tag team. Of course, you had the Von Erichs, Kerry and Kevin, or whatever combination you wanted to do. We can't forget the Dudley Brothers, the Dudley Boys. I mean, the Dudley Boys have won more titles than anybody in the history of tag team wrestling. So you can't take those guys out of the conversation. So we didn't talk about Bubba Ray and Devon, the Wild Samoans.
You know what? They were part of the mix when I first started watching as a kid.
Dude, when I went to World Class Championship Wrestling, right before Jerry Jarrett bought it out, and I was in line to go into the wrestling school, and this was back when the Samoans were wrestling as the SST. Dude, that's a badass name, the SST, yeah. Samoan SWAT team. Shit. There I was in my damn, you know, black Gerbeau jeans and my purple Izod shirt and my loafers.
You give me nice.
Poor as a motherfucker, you know, on a college scholarship trying to get in line to see a Chris Adams seminar. And here comes SST out of the dressing room, man. It was the coolest thing in the world. All the boys were coming out, and I was trying to go in to get into the business. It's kind of head-scratching when you go back. And then I can't leave off Harlem Heat, Booker T, and Stevie Ray. We tried to open the show with some Stevie Ray Vaughan. It didn't work. When they showed up on the scene in WCW way back in the day, it was like two guys show up, and they're both big and jacked up. And I got a little charisma about them. I got some edge to them. Mm-hmm. And then you see, hey, man, these guys can work too. And, yeah, one of them's really athletic. So Harlem Heat had a hell of a damn run.
Yeah, and if we're moving forward from the 80s, and you want to move into the modern day, two teams I got to call out, Fish and O'Reilly and the Revival. I love both those teams, man.
I love the Revival, Dawson and Dash, but I also liked when they were having those matches back at the time when they were a team and they weren't feuding, who would go on to have lights out singles matches, Gargano and Ciampa.
Yeah, to be honest, personally, I found those to be a bit overbooked, you know, and there were, I'm really probably too unforgiving when I watch matches. I remember watching one of their matches where Gargano got Ciampa in a hammerlock, arm up behind his back, and then obviously released the hand so that Ciampa could slap his thigh when he threw the elbow to the face to counter it. And little stuff like that just, it might make me too unforgiving for the rest of the match. and also over bumping. Those guys are both so talented. I think Ciampa is one of the few legitimate heels we got in the business these days. I don't like to see too much in a match, and I don't like to see holes in a match like that. So for me, it kind of detracted, and it was still a great match. It's still great talents, but yeah, it might have been a little less for me than it was for you. did I offend you with that?
No, that's a very astute eye that I appreciate. But in the totality of their work, the matches that those guys were having were damn good.
Oh yeah, well, the one
I appreciate the fact that you're critiquing stuff now, but we can't leave Demolition out of this equation.
Oh,
Axe
damn,
and Smash,
yeah,
yeah, dude, we got to be embarrassed. We're not thinking about all these names.
Yeah, yeah, you're right, and those guys definitely carried themselves like ass kickers. You know, when I first saw them, I thought, like a lot of people thought, oh great, it's a Road Warriors ripoff, which, you know, technically it was.
It was Road Warriors inspired for damn sure.
But they quickly made their own thing out of it to the point that they were their own tag team and they had their own aura about it. And they definitely, I bought them.
Oh, and those dudes could work their ass off too. I mean, for big guys.
Yep.
Man, one of the most impressive tag teams. I'm not going to put them in the same work category. Barb was a hell of a worker. But as far as just eyeball factor or litmus test, seeing them out there in the ring, Warlord and Barbarian.
Powers of Pain.
Dude, Powers of Pain, because Warlord had the physique from hell, right?
Just, yeah, he had to be, what, 320?
Dude, I mean, he could turn purple when the bell rang. But Barb always had those big-ass triceps.
Mm-hmm.
Warlord had the better physique, but Barb was like a very close second place. But those triceps he had just looked like hams hung up on his arms and looked like a mule had kicked him in the back of his arm, put that horseshoe, hit his big-ass fucking triceps on him. Mm. It was scary.
Yeah, yeah, I dug those guys. Again, you could call them Road Warriors clones, but they made their own thing out of it. And one team that I think they might kind of be in the same category as the Hollywood Blondes, where if the company had got behind them more, they could have made more of themselves, was Hercules and Paul Roma.
Oh, man. That was a damn good tag team.
Yeah, Power and Glory.
Yeah, I agree 100%. Because Paul Roma was the athlete of the bunch. He had a hell of a drop kick, go scientific on you, great body, good physique, good look, good package, whole thing. And then you had Hercules. God dang, Ray Hernandez. He was such a sweetheart of a guy. Fun-loving guy, and he could work his ass off. You know, he had that match with one of the WrestleManias. It was him versus Billy Jack Haynes. It was
The Full Nelson match.
Full Nelson match, and Billy puked in the match, but it's Full Nelson match. But Hercules was a hell of a damn hand, but yeah, Power and Glory was a damn good tag team.
Yeah, yeah, they were fantastic, man. I really dug them. And dude, how are we leaving out the Steiner Brothers?
I was next on my list. But you know what? Here's the thing, man. Rick and Scott Steiner were awesome as a tag team. But if you could have lost the shoot aspect just a little bit, those guys were so alpha and so based in amateur wrestling, you couldn't get too much heat on them.
Well, dude, that's why I love the match between Steve Williams and Terry Gordy and the Steiners, because it got chippy. And you could see they were competitive. Yeah. And they weren't always cooperating with each other. They weren't sandbagging, so it wasn't killing the match. But it's like they weren't helping each other out 100% either. And it made it look more like a fight.
Steiner brothers, tough as nails, good dudes. God dang, I owe Rick Steiner a phone call. We talked to each other. He's selling real estate outside Atlanta, Georgia now.
Okay.
We can't forget Doom.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Ron Simmons and Butch Reed.
Yep. And, you know, there's one tag team I didn't even know existed, and I think it came about because Terry Gordy, I don't know if it was when he had his bad episode with drugs and went into a coma for a while or if he had actually died, but they needed a partner for Steve Williams, and they got Gary Albright. I've been watching their matches, and like, what a hell of a brute tag team. You got these two. Steve Williams is the little guy at what, 270?
Yeah.
And they're both legit shooters.
Yeah.
Like, how do you
yeah, Steve was the bumper.
Yeah. He was the Ricky Morton.
Hey, man, and you know what? We can't throw out the fabulous one, Stan Lane and Steve Kern.
Oh.
Dude, when they got hot in Memphis, they were one of the hottest acts going. Two good-looking guys, good physiques, could work their ass off, pretty salty as well.
That video they got on, you'll see online, is laughable now, but at the time, man, that set them on fire.
Oh, absolutely.
That video with the top hats and the pouring the champagne in the hot tub. And yeah, yeah, that stuff was glorious.
Dude, we can't forget the Briscoe brothers. Jack and Jerry Briscoe. Dude, Briscoe would stretch my ass right now if they forgot him on his goddamn list. Shit, me and Briscoe had so much fun. Of course, you know, Jack, one of the most respected heavyweight champions in the history of the business as well. Those guys were a hell of a tag team. And they had great matches with Jay and Ricky.
Yeah, and you were talking about Bruiser Brody and Stan Hansen before. Basically, any team that involves Stan Hansen, I'm automatically a fan of. I just remember anybody they teamed with, he'd be cursing them out almost as much as his opponents. I remember during the referee's instructions, I forget who, I think it was Kawada they had him tagging with. And they're introducing the teams, and Kawada's standing forward of Hansen, and Hansen's screaming in Kawada's ear. I don't know what he's saying, but it was awesome.
Pro wrestling fans, listen up. WWE Hall of Famer and one of the greatest to ever step between the ropes, Jerry the King Lawler.
And I don't think we'd have it any other way.
Join the King and his co-host, Sean Reedy, as they get together to reflect on Jerry's legendary career from Memphis to the WWE to just about everywhere else.
Let me ask you one question. Who's the greatest wrestler in the world?
Download new episodes of The Jerry Lawler Show every Friday on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One. And if you love the show, tell your friends and leave a rating and review.
This is the Steve Austin Show.
Now that we've talked about wrestling for a little bit, you know, why in the hell are you here in L.A.? Is it just to see New Japan Pro Wrestling, or you come over here really for business? Because I know you've been busy. You used to be my stunt double. You're doing a lot of acting in Vancouver. You're still doing stunts in Vancouver, probably stunt coordinating. So why the trip to L.A.?
I just like coming down to L.A. I like seeing my friends. But, yeah, there is
you got
a
no
little
friends.
Bit. Okay, well, there's that. Thanks.
I'm kidding.
Thanks for outing me here, man. I'd like to see people who tolerate me and give me free beer and let me come on their podcast. No, it's a networking thing. I mean, there are a couple of meetings usually whenever I come down here, and especially we are talking with a couple of potentially interested parties for a second season of Paper Champions, the comedy series that just dropped on Amazon Prime that we shot, I think, last November in Calgary.
What's that airing on?
Amazon Prime. So it's an online.
God damn. Everything's on Amazon Prime. I got a watch band coming on Amazon Prime tomorrow.
Do you have Amazon
Prime?
But
you can stream all kinds of stuff on it.
Yeah, so. They got a whole video division. But I'll send you some screener links if you want to see it.
Oh, yeah, please do.
It's a comedy show about a low-level wrestling promotion, actually. But there's hardly any
fancy
wrestling.
That.
Yeah.
Well, of course there's no wrestling in it.
Well, that's why, like, Jericho asked me about it. He was really excited about the premiere. And he said, so what's it like? I said, well, there's hardly interesting in it. He said, well, good, you got it right already, because the craziest part of wrestling happens outside the ring. But it's funny because it was shot just as what they call a proof of concept. We only had 8 days to shoot it on a micro tiny budget. You know, this company TELUS, which is a big telecommunications company in Canada, they've got a fund for certain things, and they gave this production company, Rogue Panda Productions, a certain amount of money to do it, and it was like on a super shoestring. So they thought, okay, we'll shoot these seven, like 10 to 12 minute episodes, and then we'll use that to shop it around and try to sell it. And they did such a damn good job, you know, even with the low level production values, that Amazon Prime picked it up. So we're airing it and then using that and looking for proper funding and like 22 minute episodes instead of 12 minute episodes for a second season. And I just, they showed me the script for the first episode and I said, I'm in, because I just love the writing. It's definitely a comedy show about wrestling. It's not a wrestling show. And we got all kinds of help with it too. I mean, we shot a gimmick promo, which is in the guise of an old videotape somebody found with people cutting promos, trying to get into the promotion of the early 90s. Like Rey Mysterio is on there and Killer Cross is on there. And like some stars from Riverdale are on there. Boss Rutan's on there. CT Fletcher. So it's, you know, we were able to get a lot of cool people involved in it. And I'm confident that we're going to get a second season because the quality is definitely there.
Hey, what were you doing over Boss Rutan's house today? Because I was going to go with you. You sent me a text message.
Yeah.
But I had to watch Alabama play LSU. And let me talk about that for a second, because I'm a Roll Tide fan. And so I said, Roll Tide on Twitter. I was hoping they was going to be able to, you know, defeat the LSU Tigers, man. But the Tigers went into Bryant-Denny Stadium and opened up a can of whoop-ass. They played damn good football and missed. The mistakes Alabama was making was off the charts. Jesus Christ. Rough day at the office. Almost pulled it off at the end. But anyway, a few years back on a podcast, I said when Ed Orgeron was hired, I said, congrats, Ed Orgeron. That's a good hire. And a lot of people jumped on my ass and said, man, he didn't do good over at Ole Miss or wherever the hell he was at. And they said, he's going to be gone in a couple years. Well, I was right. It was a good hire. So, F you. I'm an LSU Tigers fan as well, But I just, Roll Tide is my favorite team. But I like LSU Tigers as well. I like damn near all college football teams, but I'm an SEC guy specifically. And I'm also an Oklahoma Sooners fan. Someone said to me on Twitter today, hey, man, you're a bandwagon fan. You was talking about Roll Tide, and then you abandoned the Sooners. Or you're not supposed to, you don't cheer for the Texas Longhorns. I'm like, hey, man, Roll Tide, Alabama's my favorite team. I'm from Austin, Texas. I love the Longhorns. My mother's from Guthrie, Oklahoma, so I also love the Oklahoma Sooners. I like a lot of fucking college football teams. So anybody wants to call me a bandwagon fan, go fuck yourself. I happen to like LSU Tigers, and I'm an Ed Orgeron fan as well. Can you make sense of that, or am I just fucked up?
That's the modern mentality, man. You're not allowed to like one thing and another thing. You have to pick
so you invited me to go to Boss Hooten's house with you, but I don't want to jam up your ride. Or y'all's conversation, so I don't want to be like the odd man out. I know, but I also want to watch Alabama LSU, so I turned you down, and Boss Rutten cut a promo for me on video. I'm gonna call him and see if I can air that on my Instagram account.
Okay, you'll be fine with it. I'll check with him after this. He'll be fine with it.
What's he up to now?
Oh, man, he's doing all kinds of stuff. You know, he's an inventor. He's a broadcaster. He's an actor. You know, he had a good run on that TV series Kevin Can Wait. He was a series regular on that. He's real tight with Kevin James, so, you know, he was in Kevin James' movie, Here Comes the Boom, and all the reviews on him were good from that, so expect to see him probably in more Kevin James projects and more projects overall. He invented the O2 trainer, which a lot of people are using to cure asthma right now. That's doing really well. Yeah, like Boss, a lot of people don't realize Boss had asthma so bad as a kid that he was in bed for 2-3 weeks at a time. And even when I met him, when we were both fighting the same group in Japan, he would always have his inhaler with him, and he'd hit it before he went into the ring for fights. He hasn't touched his inhaler in ages, and it's just the O2 trainer. He invented it for himself and sent it to a bunch of universities, and they're totally impartial. And they all came back and said, this thing is revolutionary, and it's helping. A lot of people are curing asthma with it right now.
I'll be damned. And then that guy, you know, it would be interesting to see him in the UFC now if he was primed up and like 30.
You know what? There's a lot of fighters where just because, you know, sports are generational. You know, I remember Michael Jordan being asked, who's better, you or Wilt Chamberlain? He said, well, that's not a fair question to ask because the game was different in his day. You know, Lennox Lewis would beat Jack Johnson, but it doesn't mean Jack Johnson wasn't as great as Lennox Lewis. But in Boss's case, it's one of the few rare cases where you could take that human being in his prime and drop him into any era of mixed martial arts, and he would wreck everybody. You know, I think Boss would probably be fighting at 185. Because his top-end weight when he was fighting was just under 210. And I think he would murder at 185, and he'd be the middleweight champion forever.
So are you going to write another book, When We Were Bouncers? What are you guys, two or three renditions out?
I got two, and I'm halfway through the third right now.
Okay, now on the third one, because you've scrapped together two solid books, and I got a chance to write the foreword for what, number one?
Number two.
Number two. You ain't get hot about it. You ain't been hitting the head with many steel chairs as I have. So you're working on number three. Now,
yes.
Are these shoot stores, or are you starting to make shit up because we're running out of material?
Absolutely not. That's what I love about this franchise.
You're damn right, because if you're in a bar, if you're prowling, there's a bunch of stories, especially if you're hanging around with knuckleheads like us and the people we find.
Yep. And it's what it still hits me with this. When I first started writing the series, I thought it was just going to be one book. And there's going to be no surprises for me. I bounced for like 20 years. I've seen it all. I've done it all. Bullshit, I have. People telling me crazy stuff that dropped my jaw. And also the perspectives on it, too. And I was initially thinking, okay, I'll get the stories about banging in the bathroom. I'll get the stories about fist fighting outside the club. I'll get the stories about all the, taking drugs and stuff, and that's about it. But then you get guys like Theo Rossi from Sons of Anarchy, and you know his chapter is really long. He gets really philosophical about the dynamic between the East Coast, where he comes from, and then he came to L.A. and started bouncing, and how people thought he was a freaking animal because they think differently. Big Rob Archer, who's an actor out of Toronto, and he got philosophical. Killer Cross is going to be in Volume 3. Same thing. He's breaking down the psychology of why things happen in a bar and why people do what they do. So you get all perspective. You get the funny ass, like just straight up, you know, shock value stories, and then you also get stuff like that. So it's so entertaining putting these stories together.
Hey, what have you learned from a psychological aspect of just watching or trying to break someone down or look at their body language or their intent or where they're at or how fucked up they are on or what they're on? Mm. How have you learned to diagnose people just from looking at them?
It's mainly experience. You see how people hold themselves. You see certain things, like they don't even realize they're giving away. Like if you see somebody waiting the back leg, leaning onto the back leg, they're loading something up. They're about to throw a windmill. You look at their hands and see if they're holding something. But that's one thing. Also, I've found a lot of the time, it's kind of like when a dog starts growling and then the growl gets real low and quiet. They're about to go. People talking like that too, especially when they're really either really angry or really fucked up on something. Same thing happens. When that pitch starts to get low, they get quiet. You better move first because they're about to move. Stuff like that.
Hey, what'd you do? Because I probably asked you this before, but it's been a long time since we've talked. Like, just as far as real deal Holyfield stuff, do you want to just remove someone from the equation, being the room or the club? Or do you ever get personal and just want to fuck somebody up? I know this is back in the old days. You're not doing it now. I'm just asking.
I hate to say it, but I'm
asking for a friend.
I'm a human being like everybody else, and it's something that actually gets referenced in when we were bouncers quite a few times. An actor named Rick Ravenella referenced it in his chapter, and it's that bouncers are human beings, and you are dealing with the worst of human behavior night after night after night. You don't know how thin that bouncer is stretched, and same with cops, and same with stuff like that. It's like, you might be coming up on that guy, and you might be the 50,000th asshole he's seen this month, and you're the straw that broke the camel's back. And I've had my camel's back broken a few times, and I've messed some people up bad just because, you know, they did step out of line. They did earn themselves a little bit of a beating. I might have gone too far with it because I thank God that there weren't cell phone cameras back then, or I'd still be in jail today. But you know, you can only deal with so much negativity. Tate Fletcher, the actor, he said, I had to quit bouncing because I was getting dark, because you just see the worst of people night after night after night. You're only seeing that side of humanity, and it skews your perception of people. And, you know, you even start dehumanizing the crowd after a while and seeing them more like livestock sometimes. And so when you see the same people coming in, you know, like I remember bouncing one night, it was Christmas Eve, and I see these people, and I know they got kids at home, and they're in there 5 nights a week anyway, getting messed up. And what, you got to be here on Christmas Eve getting drunk again, you piece of garbage. And that's no way to be looking at people. So yeah, I got to admit there were nights that I might have thrown an extra shot, or I might have been a little bit rougher than I should have been, but I never did anything to anybody who didn't put himself in that position.
There's always, Jesus Christ, I mean, hell, half the guys I know used to bounce, but it's an interesting job, but it has to be done.
Yeah.
And to hear you break it down like that scientifically, yeah, you are dealing with the worst and just the biggest assholes. And sometimes people with the best of intentions are go out, or with the worst of intentions. Man, sometimes it's just like that old T-shirt says, instant asshole, just add alcohol.
Yes.
Because that factor, I always hated, as much as I've loved to drink, you know, doing whatever I've done, you know, whether it's with wrestling or this, that, or whatever, there's always those people, and I was never one of them, that get drunk, I'm the same guy. But some people forget about it. They get loud, they get belligerent, they just get mean-spirited, they want to just fucked up.
Yeah, and you want to be that happy drunk. Like, believe me, if a bouncer...
But not too happy, turn into the obnoxious drunk that won't shut the fuck up.
You don't be the overly friendly drunk, but just the cooperative drunk. Because we love you guys, man. If you're messed up, I'm going to cut you some extra slack if you're just super cooperative when I come up on you and I got to give you instructions. There were some times, actually, that I horrified myself by leaning into a customer. There's one Filipino guy that used to come into a club called Old Bar in Vancouver. Yeah, he was a straight guy, but he always dressed like he just marched out of the Pride Parade. Man, he had like leather pants on and a mesh shirt and sunglasses, a cowboy hat. And every damn week, that guy would walk in, and like within a half hour, his ecstasy would kick in, and he'd be up on top of the speakers, and he'd bring his own glow sticks, and he'd swing his glow sticks around. I'm like, I think his name was Billy. I'm like, Billy, get off the speaker again. And finally, I'd walk up, and I'd be like his dad. I'd be slapping him in the legs. Billy, get off the freaking speaker. How many times I got to tell you? And he'd get his lower lip, but oh, I'm sorry, man. I keep forgetting. I'm sorry. But he was always cooperative. I never leaned into him. I never hurt him. And I'm so glad I didn't, because one night I was doing that, slapping him and yelling at him, and then somebody pulled me aside after one, like, dude, do you know who that is? And he was one of the biggest heatbag gangsters in Vancouver, man. Like, he said, I think people disappeared because of that guy. I'm like, oh, my God. But he was always nice to me. Thankfully, I was always nice to him, and so I'm still here to talk about it.
Hey, man, we were watching the AEW pay-per-view a while ago, and I saw you on your phone. Who are you texting? You ain't got to tell me. Reason I'm asking is because, have you ever lost or broke your phone? Are you on a smartphone? Or what, you got a Samsung or iPhone? What are you on? You're on iPhone.
Yeah.
Which one?
I think it's an 8. I always wait until mine are hopelessly obsolete and breaking down before I get a new
one. Oh, dude, they'll send a damn signal in there and start breaking it down for you. They did that to me. That's why I got this one.
Yeah.
But have you ever broke your iPhone or lost it or got it stolen?
I don't think I ever lost it, man. I broke it once, but then
You ain't never gone nowhere like sitting on a gas pump, gassed up your car, and then haul ass. And, oh, shit, left my phone on the gas pump.
No, thankfully, I've misplaced it in my apartment a few times because I had so many concussions that I can lose stuff at the drop of a dime, but I was
What do you do to find it? Do you get on your computer and do the locate thing and make it start pinging, or you just keep getting on the search
I'm
mission?
So techno-illiterate that I don't even know how that thing works.
I ain't worth a flying shit.
I just tossed my apartment, man. It looks like the DEA did a drug raid in there by the time I'm done looking for my phone, but I usually find it. You know what? Same with the Broken Skull pocket knife. You know, I've lost that damn thing so many times, but I got the orange one.
That's why I gave it to you.
Yep.
It's bright orange. Yep. So if you ever think you see it, you'll see it because
exactly.
It's bright-ass orange.
I lost count of how many times I lost that thing, but it always comes back.
I love the OD green. I love the coyote tan and the gray one. That's all fine and dandy, but I stick with the blue one and the orange one because they're the easiest to see.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to go back to the iPhone because the other day I was out there riding my – I got a new buggy. I got a KRX 1000.
That thing looks badass, by the way.
Dude, it's unreal. It's next-level handling.
I enjoyed your Polaris, but I want to ride with you on that
one. Dude, this thing is unbelievable. So I'm not going to make a plug for the new buggy, but I was out riding it. So I'm trying to get footage of it. And it's what I do. I mean, that's one of the few things other than pro wrestling that I'm so passionate about. I like to ride my side-by-sides and my four-wheelers. So I'm out there, and I was riding with my buddy, Jim Craig, and here's your shout-out. Sam Craig is a former Army Ranger.
Mm.
And so we're riding along. He goes, hey, man. He goes, pull over. He goes, let me set my phone right there in the middle of the road and ride over it. So I rode over it real slow. He goes, no. He goes, back up and really ride over it. What do you mean straddle it, you know, with the front wheels, but I'm riding right over the middle of it. And I said, okay. So I backed up and zoomed by. It was a badass shot. I put it on Instagram, Steve Austin, BSR. And who are you on Instagram?
I'm Famous Bouncers.
Famous Bouncers on Instagram, Paul Azenby. So anyway, we did the shot with Jim, and then he had to go scout for his mule deer hunt, which he bagged today. And so I was out there riding by myself, which I usually am. And it's hard to drive fast when you're trying to film yourself with an iPhone. Ain't safe. I don't recommend it. Don't do it. So I figured, well, hell, I'll just get a rock, prop up my iPhone, and ride over like I did with Jim. So I did. And when I did, it blew the phone over. So I made the approach shot. I didn't know I'd blown over at the time. I ride back. Zoom. And some bitch is laying on his damn side. I said, okay. There was a left-hand sweeping curve there. So I said, well, it'd be cool if I prop this thing up between a few rocks, kind of point it cat a corner, shows me coming, and then I'll drift over it. Set it up, do it, action. I gave myself my own cue. Backed up about 250 yards, and boy, here I come, sliding around that corner, and I did exactly what I wanted to do with the front two tires, just drifted right over it. The damn iPhone was propped up between two rocks, and it shot the chassis of the front end of my buggy, both wheels straddling it. But what I didn't account for was that drift and that damn left rear tire. Pow! And boy, I hit them damn rocks and that damn iPhone, and I come to a damn stop about 100 yards away, and I'm thinking to myself, oh, shit. I hope that OtterBox saved it. And I rode up on that sumbitch, and it was bent up. It was more ergonomic to hold it to the side of your face, but it was broken to broke dick dog. And I'm thinking to myself, God dang, I just got out here. It was only the second pass I made. I'd only left the house 10 minutes ago. And right then and there, my world stopped. I couldn't communicate with my wife. If she sent me a text message, if something went wrong, if she needed me, she could get hold of me. If there's an important call that might come from anybody, I can't get it because my phone don't work. So all of a sudden, you get cut off from society.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't post all the cool shit I just filmed. And I didn't back up my phone, so I didn't have time to back it up,
damn.
So I lost all the cool-ass footage I had shot. So anyway, there I am. So I'm thinking to myself, man, are you kidding me? Are you this effing stupid that you just ran over your phone? Now, bear in mind, when I ran over that thing, it was a brand-new phone. I'd only had it for about 3 or 4 months.
Hmm.
So I'm sitting there for about Well, that happened at 3:30 that afternoon. We go back 500 miles the next day. So, dude, to be without an iPhone for a day is almost torture. Here's the thing. Let me ask you a question. How many phone numbers in your phone do you have memorized?
Maybe 3 or 4.
Do you know my number?
Oh, man, I don't think I do.
I know my wife's number, and that's the only number I have memorized. So if I'm going to try to call anybody else, if something happens, I can't call them, because you're not forced to memorize that shit anymore. Mm-hmm. Just because it's the way it is. So anyway, I'm like, okay, we drive 500 miles. We get to the house. I unload the suitcase in the cooler. I said, hey, you get all those stuff, and I'm going to go down to the Apple store and get another iPhone. Dude, you always wait for the next call for the next project, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let me ask you a question. Your phone goes dead. Nobody can get a hold of you. What do you do?
Get straight to the Apple store, get another phone.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But you got to have that connection.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's your lifeline.
Yeah, that's how I get my business. So
that's right.
It's funny because I went on the Jericho cruise last year, and they take you out of cell phone range. They tell you that. And, you know, it's actually refreshing being out of touch for that long, but you got to have premeditated cutoff where you know you're going to be cut off for those 4 days. Otherwise, yeah, I panic.
Yeah, but also you didn't destroy your phone just because you were so stupid.
No,
you knew that you was going to be out of range.
Yeah, I didn't get unexpectedly cut off because, yeah, I would panic because it's like, well, who knows? Maybe I could get a lucrative job offer that I'm not getting now.
So, yeah, we get back. I get in the goddamn Jeep, drive down to the Apple store. It's about 8 miles away in L.A. traffic, and I get there, and I say, hey, man, I got my phone in a Ziploc baggie. and I'm thinking, okay, if I tell them the real story, are they going to cover me on my insurance for my Apple Care, whatever it's called, you know, my insurance policy? And I'm sitting there thinking, well, I'm going to tell the story on the podcast. I got to shoot straight with them. What am I going to say? I just dropped it on the sidewalk. It's bent smithereens. So I got to shoot with them. When you get to the Apple store, you get in queue. You get in line, right? It's all organized. And so the person greets you and says, hey, I'm so-and-so. What can I do for you? Hold up the baggie. I need a new iPhone. They said to me, what happened? I said, I ran over it in my four-wheeler. I don't say side-by-side because they're not going to get that. Four-wheeler, they'll probably understand. Mm. If I got to go a little bit more basic than that, I ran over it in a Jeep. They understand that. Okay,
I understand.
Yeah, they could say it's destroyed. So anyway, I'm sitting there. I got to get a new iPhone, and all of a sudden, here comes my technician. They say, "Okay, my name is so and so. How you doing?" You shake hands, and what are you here for? Well, I want to trade this iPhone in. You got Apple Care? Yeah. Okay, it's gonna be $99, but it's gonna be a 4-hour wait. And I'm thinking, I just drove 500 miles, came over here 8 miles in L.A. traffic. I'm a global icon, a national treasure. And now I'm going to sit out there in a damn mall and wait for 4 hours with my thumb up my ass. I can't go down to El Segundo Brewing Company, get drunk, and come back because then I'll get a DUI. So I'm just going to sit there with my thumb up my ass for 4 hours. And I say, okay, I just wanted to swap phones to get the same phone, the iPhone 10. I said, well, what if I upgrade? What are you going to give me for this phone with the Apple Care? And just let me get out of here now. And they said, well, we can get you in a 12, 11, 13, whatever. It's 11 Pro. What's this one with three lenses?
I
got
it.
I said, I want to save time. Give me this one so I get out of here.
You shop like a guy. Yo, yeah. Get me in, get me out.
Yeah. And so all of a sudden I end up with this phone, and I got to go back 2 days later to turn the phone in. So anyway, I get this new phone that you're seeing right now in my hand, and I'm connected, and I'm so damn mad because I got gypped. I just wanted to do the $99 upgrade, but I can't wait 4 hours. I got shit to do.
Why don't they just pull another one out?
Well, it was busy as hell, but that's where the work started. No beef against Apple. Great technician, but that's a work. That's a bigger work as pro wrestling.
They got them in a box, man.
Yeah. They got 100 of them.
Yeah.
They got 200 of them. What? 300 of them. What? 400? Bullshit. So I'm sitting there, and, dude, I just want to get out.
Mm.
And I'm cheap as a motherfucker. Anybody in the wrestling business knows me, knows how frugal I am. But time is money, and I'm ready to get out. So I said, okay, I'll take the damn three lens ones and get me out of here. So I get it. I'm happy with it, whatever. And I get the iWatch. I got an iWatch because if you lose your phone, you can still use your iWatch. So this is my backup plan. And I'm not going to wear it 24/7, but I got a backup plan so I can stay in touch with my wife.
Mm.
So anyway, a couple days later, I go back to the store and they start quick talking me again. It's like an auctioneer on amphetamines. And I'm like, and I'm sitting there, I'm confused. And I've been hitting the head with a couple steel chairs. And I said, can you explain that to me again? Because I don't understand what you're saying. And they broke it down to me again. I said, well, so-and-so, my technician said I was going to get, they were trying to undercut me $100 on my phone. And I said, so-and-so said I was going to get $600 for it. And I said, why am I getting this for it? And they said, well, let us go check. And I was being real cool, but I was very confused. And then all of a sudden, my technician from a few days earlier came out and said, okay, we're going to give you $600 for it. Everything's cool, right? I said, oh, yeah. I just want to get my rebate. Get out of here. What they made me do was turn my broken-down iPhone in, keep my memory chip. They handed me a brand-new 10X, and then they said, okay, now we're going to take it away from you so we can turn this in so that you can keep your 11 Pro. And I said, what? I said, really? I said, we had to do that? We had to go through that whole process? Why don't I just – you didn't have to bring out this phone and scan it in.
That makes no sense.
It makes no sense. So anyway, I was lost without my iPhone is the point of the story. And it was a rotten experience. But what I want to do, Paul, I just want to go to a flip phone.
You know what? If I keep telling people, you will know that I won the lottery because my social media activity will dwindle and I will be carrying a flip phone. Because if I don't need an iPhone for business, yeah, it's kind of a lot less stress.
All right, let's take it back to wrestling. You were talking about a little bit of early school, old school NWA stuff. How much of the old USWA stuff with Lance Russell did you watch? Because you got a picture with him.
Yeah, a USWA... I didn't get, so I'm watching it recently because it's being rebroadcast on ESPN Classic Canada. But I didn't get to see it. I got all my USWA information and all my WCCW information, which is what that company was before that, from Pro Wrestling Illustrated. Because, you know, this is pre-internet. That's all I got. So I knew all the names and faces. But I did get to see some Lance Russell stuff when the Fight Network started showing Memphis Wrestling. Enough that, you know, I met Lance Russell at PopCon, which was put on by Jeff Osborne in Indiana. And, Jeff being a good friend of mine made sure my table was really close to Lance's. And so I got to meet him there. I'm really glad I did, man. Like, he's an absolute gentleman, that guy. And of course, a legend of the business.
Did you get a chance to see enough of his work though, to see that when he was doing the interviews by ringside or by desk side, when he was doing the commentary with Dave, he could sit there and talk to a guy. And if the guy wasn't a good talker, he could ask him a question and basically him, he had that draw. He could basically, you know, either get heat on you or get sympathy or people on your side. He could basically ask a question and answer it for you if you couldn't talk, or if you could talk, he could have a hell of a conversation with you. But he had that gift of just never-ending flow of conversation.
It's one thing that when I started watching his stuff with an educated eye, I saw that where he would frequently be cutting guys off if they were getting tongue-tied. And usually when an interviewer is cutting off the subject, it gets annoying because, like, the guy's trying to get his message out and you're stopping him from doing that. In Lance's case, I never picked up on the fact he was cutting guys off because if the like you said, if the wrestler was having trouble with the flow of what he was trying to say, then Lance would push it along in that direction as well. He'd be going in the same way. And he just insinuate himself at the right moment and draw the conversation along, then ask a leading question and get a little more out of the guy and then do it again. Yeah, he was so good at that.
Since we're on the subject of wrestling, let's end with wrestling. And New Japan Wrestling is the flavor of the day because that show is on, what, Monday or Tuesday?
Monday, the 11th.
Okay, this will be the day after that show airs. And I know you're going to see Juice Robinson. What do you think of the New Japan Pro Wrestling product?
I like it because I like a little more. I like wrestling to treat itself like it's a little more legitimate, take itself a little more seriously. And the current tone of a lot of companies, and I'm not demonizing it. If that's your product, then great, watch that. But I tend to my eyes glaze over when I see a company that's not taking itself seriously. When it's like, well, everybody knows it's fake, so we don't have to try to make you believe that it's real. And I would rather see the company portray itself as something real. And so in New Japan's case, it's more of a sporting aspect. It seems a lot more legitimacy to me. Of course, there's cartoonish stuff like there isn't any wrestling company. But overall, it seems more like a sporting thing, and the matches feel more like conflicts and contests than two guys cooperatively going through a bunch of moves. So it's very much to my taste. I really like that company. And, you know, I like seeing, you know, Minoru Suzuki's a friend of mine, and I respect the hell out of him as a fighter, so it's great to see him in the pro wrestling industry, you know, at 50 years old, still tearing it up and still carrying himself like one of the most legitimately scary guys in the company. So him in particular I like to watch.
Hey, what happened to the Japan scene? Because you've seemed to kind of study or really like that stuff, and I did as well, the New Japan, All Japan stuff from back in the day, and then everybody started fractioning, splitting off to FMW and all the other different groups. What is the scene like over there anymore? Is it only New Japan, or do those other companies exist, and are they doing lesser business? What is the scene over there compared to what it is over here in the United States?
Well, there's been a parallel because the big two used to be All Japan and New Japan. They were like WWF and WCW. And then just like WCW fell off, and All Japan kind of fell off and became a much smaller company. I'm not saying the wrestling's worse. I'm just saying they fell on harder times. Wrestling overall in the mid-2000s seemed to be suffering in Japan. But MVP would be a good guy to ask about that, because he voluntarily, just because it was his dream to go over there, he left WWE, he asked for his release, and he went to New Japan at a time where the Japanese wrestling scene wasn't that strong, just to be in that scene. But New Japan has held their ground as the number one group in the number one company in the country. You know, they still, you know, fill the Tokyo Dome. I've been to the last three Wrestle Kingdoms, Wrestle Kingdom being their version of WrestleMania. And, you know, they're filling the Tokyo Dome. You know, Jericho's had a lot to do with it too, but they're still a very strong company that can do that. And All Japan is still, you know, they're on the rise again. You know, there was Pro Wrestling Noah for a while, which was very strong, and they've kind of fallen off a bit since their patriarch Misawa died. But it's kind of like over here where there's a lot of companies that are doing decent business and getting their guys paid, but you know who the big dogs are.
How big a fan were you of the Misawa Kawada matches? Because those guys seemingly used to beat the shit out of each other. And I would watch some of their matches, and as impressive as they were, because they were, those guys were working their asses off. And I was known as being snug to somewhat stiff, but just laying my shit in. But I figured there could have been an easier way. Your thoughts on that, because you were really into that.
Yeah, that's, you know, they call it King's Road in All Japan, and it was the equivalent of Strong Style in New Japan. To be honest, I found even when I, early in my career, you know, I was a Lance Storm trainee. Lance is very, very proud of the fact that he never hurt anybody in any of his matches in his entire career. He wasn't stiff. He was precise. And you know, every once in a while, if he's a little bit snug, it was in a safe spot. You know, like William Regal says, hit you hard in safe places. So that was always my mentality, is we're in here to put on a show and not injure each other in the process. Both get out of here uninjured. And I do like being laying my stuff in a little bit and being a little snug at times. It helps the overall performance, but yeah, in safe places. So when I would see guys doing those high angle suplexes and dropping each other on their heads, I would just think, why is that necessary? I mean, that those guys were so good at telling stories, and they had the crowd up anyway with their psychology. Why do you need that tiny little bit of extra pop that comes from, you know, dropping somebody right on the top of their head? You know, it wasn't necessary. And ultimately, you know, the number of times that happened to Misawa killed him, because, you know, he took one regular bump and it snapped his neck because it was hanging by a thread. So, yeah, it just... That actually, those were great matches that I love to watch, but those moments in the matches do take me out of it a little bit, because they just cringe and think, that was necessary, man. Why are you doing that to yourselves?
Man, I was the same way, just because as hardcore as I am, as much as I love the business, I was like, man, really? You're there. You got him.
Yeah.
Easy.
If you want to be borderline stiff in a match, do it the way William Regal and Fit Finlay did at WCW Uncensored in 2008. Until the end of that match, and it had to end in an unscheduled fashion because Finlay got a little bit excited and completely broke half the bones in Regal's face. But those guys beat the hell out of each other, but it was, I hit you hard in safe places. There were times they were being outright stiff, but never during that match did I think, oh my God, you know, that guy could have been paralyzed by that.
Right.
It was just two guys beating the hell out of each other and putting on a great match. You know, those two talents, they were telling a great story. And then, you know, and one of Finley's punches just came through a little bit too much. And you know how badass Finlay is, and Regal's face suffered for it. But That's one of my favorite matches to watch, and that's an example of if you like to work snug, if you like to make it dirty and nasty and ugly, do it that way, because those guys weren't doing anything that was jeopardizing the other guy's life.
I got to rewatch it. It's been a long time since I've seen that. Hey, man, where can people find you? What are you doing? When will When We Were Bouncers 3 come out?
I am currently... I already did, made my exit from the Gears of War franchise, but you can see my work in Gears of War 5, which just came out. The studio, I left the game because the studio aggressively suppresses the fact that the motion capture team, of which I'm a part, I play Marcus Phoenix, we do 95% of the work, and then they don't want us getting any attention at all, so I just kind of get a little bit tired of that. Yeah, they only want, like, the voice talent, due credit to them. You know, they do a good job of the voices, and they deserve the credit they get. I got no grudge against them. But in the studio's mind, those are the only stars of the game. Now, we don't just do the stunts. We do all the acting. We do all the, like, everything you see those characters do on the screen, including the dialogue. We're doing all of that, and then the voices are redubbed by the voice talent. So when it got to the point where they dressed up the voice talent in motion capture suits and shot a behind-the-scenes video and put it online and said, hey, look, here's the cast doing the motion capture. I'm like, okay, I'm tapping out, guys. But it was, you know, I do feel privileged to be a part of that franchise because it's a really popular franchise. The Gears of War fans are fantastic. So you can see my work in Gears of War 5. I won't be back as Marcus Phoenix again. You know, I've been in the last three games. So leaving that, thankfully, hasn't really slowed me down at all. I've been working on all summer on the main event, which is a WWE/Netflix movie. That'll be coming out next year. And I got to work with a lot of the talent like Keith Lee and Dozovic and Eric Bugenhagen, me and Ace Steele, who trained CM Punk, we put most of their wrestling scenes together, and then I helped them work out all the wrestling scenes and work out the wire gags, and I wore about five or six hats on that, and I'm also on camera as one of the wrestlers. So that's coming out next year. There's an episode of Batwoman that actually will have aired two or three days ago that I stunt doubled the executioner for, so I'm trying to kill Batwoman on that. I'm bouncing around all the CW shows, getting my ass kicked by every superhero in Vancouver, so that's what's going on with that. Thankfully, my career momentum is pretty good right now, so I'm grateful for that. And, When We Were Bouncers 3 is in process. I think I'm almost halfway there. You know, the sweet spot for me is between 30 and 35 chapters in that range. I'm just about halfway there. So,
and again, some of these stories are actually true. I'm kidding you. I'm fucking with you.
Some being 100%.
Some being so true that they make up for the ones that were bullshit. Hey, so you've been doing more and more acting.
Yes.
Are you enjoying that?
I love it, man. It's they treat you way better. It's crazy.
Yeah,
I don't get treated bad as a stunt guy, but it's so funny, man. I'll work on a show like Supernatural. I've been on that show a million times. And so say a show like that where I'm on multiple times, and I'll be there busting my head open or flat backing on concrete. And they treat me good. And then I audition for a role, and I get on set as an actor. And my job is to stand on that spot on the floor and say three lines and then go home. And everybody's treating me like I'm royalty. I'm like, dude, I'm the most useless guy on this set. Everybody here is working harder than me, and now you're treating me good when I was busting my head for you guys last season.
Yeah, no, get it, stunt man. But it's like same business when you come from wrestling or from back in the old days. I can't speak to the new style or whatever's going on now. But, you know, I just go do some gigs. All of a sudden you show up on the set, and like you're treated like royalty, to your point. And it's like, God dang. Shit. I'm a human being. First time I've ever been treated like this in my professional career. So, yeah, it's funny how they treat stuntman or whatever different. All of a sudden, you assume the acting chops, and you're a different guy. When, like you said, you've been busting your ass trying to make these guys look good, and you're treated like, you know, okay, whatever.
Yeah,
this tough guy, just meathead, lunkhead, okay, whatever.
Dude, I literally, and it was kind of ribbon on the square, as we say. It was a joke, but it wasn't a joke. One of my very first jobs, I was a stunt actor, so that's a new designation where you show up and you're doing your own stunts, but you get an elevated pay because you're acting too. And I was laying on a concrete floor. I'd just been shot. And they had me laying there for a long time. And the director, who actually was a really good guy, we got along really well, but he walks up and he's asking him, are you okay? And then he comes over and he's like, dude, you've been laying there a long time. Are you okay? Oh, no, wait, you're just a stunt guy. I don't have to care about you. And he walks away.
He told you that?
Oh, yeah. I'm like, oh, dude, that was stiff.
Yeah. That's when you call catering and say, hey, can you bring a little salt to rub on me? Well, anyway, great talking with you. And where can people find you on social media?
On Twitter, at Mahler MMA, and also at Famous Bouncers, and on Instagram, at Famous Bouncers.
Jesus Christ, sounds like you better follow him and beat your ass. Paul Lazenby, ladies and gentlemen, here at the crib.
The 316 Gimmick Street on the mean streets of Los Angeles.
I've renamed this place. I've renamed it.
Oh, you have?
Yeah, Broken Skull Studio.
Ah, well, you're all fancy now.
Well,
I like the way you remodeled this place last time I was here.
316 Gimmick Street, you know, cool, but up the ante a little bit. Broken Skull Studio.
Well, it does fit the new look because I like it in here.
All right, everybody, give me the go home. Q's time to wrap up this podcast and ride off in the sunset. But before I do that, I want to thank my guest, Paul Lazenby, my good friend, former stunt double for Vancouver, BC, author of When We Were Bouncers 1, 2, and 3 is in the works. We'll let you know when that is available. Good time talking with Paul, as it always is, and good seeing a familiar face over here at the Broken Skull Studios. Paul, let me know when you're back here in Los Angeles, and I may go to the New Japan Pro Wrestling Show with you. I don't know. We will find out as that day gets here. Hey, if you want to reach me here on the podcast, send an email to questions@steveaustinshow.com. And a heads up to everybody out there on the East Coast, my IPA, Steve Austin's Broken Skull IPA from El Segundo Brewing Company, is out on the East Coast in Massachusetts, New Jersey, and New York. We've got another shipment headed your way because all of the locations were basically sold out. Check ElSegundoBrewing.com and check the interactive map to find a location that sells it closest to you. Broken Skull IPA is still available in California. We're mostly available at Whole Foods and Total Wines. King of Attitude shirts and Broken Skull shirts over at ProWrestlingTees.com. And got a badass pocket knife, the Broken Skull Knife or the Working Man's Knife, Amazon.com/shop/Steve Austin. I want to say one more thank you to all the fine sponsors of the Steve Austin Show, especially Zorro.com, Geico, and BetOnline.ag. That's how I'm able to do this podcast for you twice a week for free. Please support them because they support us. And if you need more info on my sponsors, check out the show description to this episode for details. Folks, until next time, my name is Steve Austin. And I will catch your ass down the road.
This has been a Podcast One production. Download new episodes of The Steve Austin Show every Tuesday at PodcastOne.com. That's PodcastOne.com.